Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Muddy Knees Media.
For the rest of this month being September 2020, you can take out a subscription to The Athletic for the frankly ridiculous price of £12. And that's not £12 a month, that's £12 for the entire year. That's unrivaled football writing and analysis from the very best people in the business, a brand spanking new breaking news service, and ad-free versions of each Athletic podcast, all for just £1 a month. Go to theathletic.com/totally to get started.
Totally Football Show. Today, a brand new season is underway. At Anfield, El Loco commotion as electric Leeds almost give Liverpool a real shock. Elsewhere, it's a bad weekend for the Hammers, but a good one for James. And while Spurs slump, it's Arsenal this time, who have a Fulham crew trailing them all afternoon. We review the opening day's action, discuss the rule of 10, why matches don't go to double figures, and much, much more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hello, listener. It's Monday, the 14th of September, as you probably don't need reminding. We are six games into the opening weekend, and here on the Totally Football Show, we're joined by author and journalist Daniel Storey.
Hi, James.
Hello, Daniel. Author and tactical historian of the Premier League era, Michael Cox, is with us.
Hi, James.
Hello, Michael. As is commentator and fabled seer, Matt Davis Adams. Matt, since you're here... Make the curtains twitch and the candles flicker in our imaginations with one of your predictions as we stand at the start of a new campaign. What's going to happen? Something big. Come on.
I mean, I'd just like to take this opportunity to announce my retirement from the predictions game, having won it last season. No, I don't know. give me till the window closes. I did think today, watching the late game, that Eric Dier and Dele Alli could play a really important part in West Ham's promotion bid next season, but I won't quite make that one official yet.
Right. Okay. Watching the action this weekend, Denim John says, "I'm not whelmed. Could you help me be more excited about the weekend?" I'm not sure what Denim John was expecting, because I thought that was a weekend that had kind of everything. I mean, everything except fans, of course, but you had whirlwind attacking goals fest like the one at Anfield, gritty attritional wins like Selhurst Park, and some really sparkling debuts.
I thought it was pretty good. Yeah, I mean, it probably took me... I kind of had to get over the lack of fans again, because like the start of the new season just feels like... You know, the end of a season's about deciding results and deciding the table, whereas the start of the season's about fan excitement. But yeah, once I'd got over that, I thought there were some really great games. Even the last one, only one goal in it, Everton-Spurs, I thought was quite an intriguing game. So yeah, I was relatively whelmed.
Yeah, I was pretty whelmed too. But the fans thing, I think I'd kind of naively led myself into believing that the start of this season would be different to the end of last season. And of course it isn't. It doesn't look like it's going to be for quite a while. And it is difficult to get used to and get as enthused by. There's a really good piece actually on The Athletic that's gone up today by Stuart James about kind of missing the match day experience. And there's a line that he's put in there that says it's just a football match now, no more than that. And if you read the piece, you get the context of it. But I do kind of get that. And maybe part of that's because I've stopped watching with crowd effects as well. And so you are just, you know, there are times where it does feel like you're watching a training session rather than watching a Premier League match. And it's better than nothing, but it's not what it was.
I see, Matt. All right. Well, the score so far, we've just seen Everton actually on this Sunday get their first away win against a big six side in 41 attempts, a 1-0 victory at Spurs. Earlier today, Leicester won 3-0 at West Brom. All the promoted sides losing, in fact, on this opening weekend. Saturday, Arsenal proved they can do it on a warm September afternoon in Fulham. A 3-0 for them. Liverpool saw off Leeds just in a 7-goal humdinger. Palace upset the predictions with a 1-0 win over Saints. And Newcastle won 2-0 away at West Ham in the one club you wouldn't swap your owners with derby. Monday coming up later on today, there's Wolves at the Blades and Brighton hosting Chelsea. All right, well, we're going to draw some hasty conclusions on the opening 90 minutes in the games that have been played. Let's start at Anfield.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Taken by Robertson, touched by Strauch. Oh! Salah! The goals are not going to stop.
Are we watching a computer game or something? I mean,
match of the weekend, Liverpool 4, Leeds 3. Liverpool preserving their undefeated home run in the league, which now stretches to 60 matches, but only just. It took a wayward leg from Leeds record signing Rodrigo with just 2 minutes to go that earned Jurgen Klopp's side the penalty, with which they earned the 3 points. Wow. How did Leeds do what they did to Liverpool? Luis Caia says, my uneducated eye suggests that they just pressed, then broke with lots of men. But what's the educated explanation of the Bielsa tactics?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's an unreasonable summary of the situation. I think the main factor they had was lots of men going in behind. Liverpool play a very high defensive line, and I think that caused them problems on various occasions. I think they just put Liverpool's defenders under pressure in certain situations. I mean, Virgil van Dijk made a very rare error for the goal. And of course, I mean, we can only give Leeds a certain amount of credit because they conceded 4 goals. But when you look at the concessions, I mean, 2 of them were penalties kind of out of nothing. It wasn't like Leeds were really opened up. One was, OK, poor defending from a set piece. And the other was a pretty unstoppable Mohamed Salah strike. So, yeah, I was just impressed by the intensity, by their commitment to attack. And they probably fared better than I expected, really. I kind of thought they would play well and lose, but they probably played better than I thought and didn't lose by as much as I thought.
On the subject of Van Dijk's error, Sasha, who watches a lot of Liverpool, says, I think that error was actually just Bielsa really doing his homework because he spotted that that's how Van Dijk deals with balls coming in over his shoulder and has told Bamford to go and exploit that. Broadly speaking, what was your take on Leeds, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two elements or two stats kind of summed up quite nicely. One pretty tenuous and the other less so. The first is that Liverpool had less possession than they almost always have against non-Big Six teams. The only other time they've had less possession against a non-big team at home in the Premier League under Klopp was against Brighton when they were reduced to 10 men with 20 minutes to go. So that kind of skewed it slightly. So that was the first thing that, you know, they do press, but they don't just, it's not quite harum-scarum football in that they get the ball and then immediately try and score. You know, they do look quite direct, like with the, you know, for with like Phillips for Harrison's goal, but there's a little bit more to it than that. And the other thing which we do know about Leeds under Bielsa is just that intense pressing and tackling. You know, it's the most by and away team in a Premier League against Liverpool under Klopp, 33 tackles. So, yeah, both of those things kind of sum up Leeds. And Bielsa was kind of annoyed after the game, and understandably so, because he said, it's all very well and I'm very happy with how we played, but you can't make those mistakes. And if you make those mistakes in this league, we're going to get punished. And I guess my only concern was it felt like, as soon as they got the third goal, it looked like getting that goal had really sapped them of energy and they looked pretty tired in the last 10-12 minutes, which is understandable against Liverpool, but it's also the start of a pretty long season. They coped pretty well last season with it, but I don't know how that goes deep into a season, but it'll be really good to find out because it was so watchable.
There were a couple of things that I noticed, obviously having watched Leeds fairly closely for the last couple of seasons. The first was the real flip reverse of a Virgil van Dijk error leading to a Patrick Bamford goal with his first shot of the game, which was not something that happened very often last season. And in terms of mitigation for the concession of 4 goals, they were without their captain, Liam Cooper, who's a centre-half, and alongside him last season was Ben White, who was probably the best central defender in the Championship, who's now back at Brighton. So they've got two sort of relatively untested players in that position, so I guess you could give that as an excuse. And Jack Harrison scoring and just the story of his route into football and the way that he's got to where he is now, which I think is really remarkable and something that kind of hasn't been reported on enough. So good to see him making headlines.
Report on that story for us, Matt.
So he was or is from Bolton, raised in a single parent family by his mum. He was at Man United as an under eight. She took a very close interest and didn't feel like he was getting the kind of attention that he ought to have done, and that the idea that United had was of this big group of kids, we get one through, that's fine. And she didn't think that was going to work for him. So she did a lot of research and found that there was a private boarding school in Massachusetts, which she thought would be good for him because they had a good coach. She applied for a scholarship there, got a full scholarship after allaying fears of the school about Jack Harrison's physique and stamina. She provided them with a medical report from Man United about his bone density, which indicated that he would actually fill out quite nicely as an adult. He goes to this school.
How old was he at the time, Matt?
This time he would have been early teens.
Right.
So he goes to the school.
I mean, to put that in perspective, so they're from Bolton. That's kind of like, that's further than you would go for a COVID test, essentially. They went all the way to Massachusetts to find an adequate educational facility.
Yeah, yeah. He goes through that, gets into the collegiate system, actually gets drafted in the MLS by Chicago Fire, but they trade him to New York City, obviously parent club. Being Manchester City, who spot something in him, take him back. Patrick Vieira was the New York City FC manager at that time. There's a story about him having watched England in Euro 2016 at Frank Lampard's house in New York. And anyway, yeah, City take him. He becomes a City player, and now he's in his third season on loan at Leeds. Scored at Anfield on his Premier League debut. It's a pretty incredible story.
It's amazing. Do you agree broadly with Daniel's point about tiredness and fatigue, or was your take on them more positive?
Yeah, well, this is the classic Bielsa thing that normally comes at the end or around the middle of the season, actually, is when you start to say that they're looking tired. But yeah, I did think that in this game. And if it happens to one player, it's going to happen to all of them, because inevitably with the style that they play, the key to making it work is that everybody buys into it. So everybody's going to be exhausted by the end of the game if they've been doing their jobs properly.
That said, it was a remarkably gutsy performance, the way that they came back three times against the champions who'd taken the lead. You mentioned the new faces at the back, one of them Robin Koch conceding that penalty because of handball. Koch blocking, actually, to borrow James Horncastle's line, within 3 minutes of his Premier League debut. And Mo Salah with a couple of penalties and a brilliant other goal, but a couple of crackers as well. That long ball from Calvin Phillips up for the Harrison goal was very, very special. More of that, please.
Yeah, and I think that will be quite an encouraging thing, that Leeds managed to get one of their key players in space, despite the fact that Liverpool know how they're going to play. I mean, sometimes people talk about a team coming up from the Championship, oh, they might surprise people. I mean, Liverpool will have so many opposition analysts who have been scrutinising the way Leeds play, and they do play in a very particular way. And yet it wasn't that Liverpool were surprised by them. I think it's just that Leeds do some things very well and cause the opposition problems. I think equally, probably for the Leeds players, it was a bit of a learning curve. And I think what they will find is that there are players at Premier League level who can do things that players at Championship level can't. And I think a couple of those things would be, one, Roberto Firmino plays the false nine role, I would imagine, in a much better way than any player in the Championship. And I think he dragged them around and caused them problems. And secondly, the way that they play without the ball, Leeds, they basically man-mark the opposition, which means Bamford, you know, is pressing one of the centre-backs, and they have a spare man at the back, and that means they leave one of the opposition centre-backs free. And I think what we saw here was Van Dijk and Gomez can both carry the ball forward into midfield really well and exploit the fact that everyone else is occupied. So there'll be a couple of changes from the way that they played in the Championship, but overall I think it was pretty positive.
And any conclusion you'd like to draw for Liverpool on this 90 minutes?
I mean, they were defensively sloppy. The word of this summer in terms of doubting Liverpool has been complacency. And I think people maybe underestimate or kind of misappropriate that term and look at it inaccurately. We're not talking about players looking back fondly at what they've done and not caring about this season. We're not talking about players kind of taking a huge sigh of relief. It's those completely inadvertent lapses of concentration or slight loss of focus that at Premier League level, even against one of the promoted teams, will be the difference between conceding three goals and conceding one goal, maybe. And maybe we saw slight elements of that. I thought that Trent Alexander-Arnold looked as flat-footed defensively. I know he's not perfect, but as flat-footed defensively as I've seen him in a Premier League game in a while. Van Dijk obviously makes a mistake that he wouldn't normally make, but They did just look a little bit open. I don't know if that's because Naby Keita was playing, you know, and he's not been playing that much starting or what, but they did just look a little bit open. And they were they were basically really lucky that Mohamed Salah was absolutely brilliant. I thought he was. I thought what he did really well is he seemed to know when to stay high up the pitch and when to drop deep and pick up the ball. You know, no Liverpool players had more shots in a Premier League game than Salah's nine for about 4.5 years. So he kind of dominated his battle.
It's interesting what Daniel says about Alexander-Arnold. I agree he wasn't great and got caught out for one of the goals, but I think probably his worst game of last season was the opening day against Norwich. So maybe he's a bit of a Harry Kane figure who takes a while to get going.
The match that Norwich almost won.
Famously, yeah.
So nearly, yeah. Okay, well, it was a close one this, but it is 3 points for Liverpool. And we move on next to Saturday's action and Craven Cottage.
This season, the Premier League's going to be a little bit different. But at Paddy Power, we're trying to embrace the new normal by looking at the upside. Avoid unnecessary journeys. That's Fulham's trip to Anfield off. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates has never sounded so good. Self-isolate. Well, some midfielders do that very effectively. Avoid European travel. Shouldn't be a problem for Everton fans. When you think about it, not that much has changed, really. New normal, same old football. Paddy Power. 18+, begambleaware.org.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Saturday lunchtime on the banks of the River Thames. The Premier League season got underway with a 3-0 win for Arsenal at Craven Cottage. It was Lacazette who opened the scoring. Gabriel then added another goal, part of a very impressive debut for him before Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang scored the best goal you'll see all season, according to Martin Keown. Bold stuff, rivaling Matt there for the prediction crown. But Arsenal, there are corollaries that you have to say. Willian had the 3 assists. Mkhitaryan had 3 assists on his Gunners debut as well. And Arsenal equally, last time they went to Craven Cottage, beat Fulham 5-1. That was under Emery. Neither of those things presaged a new golden era for the Gunners. But that said, there were so many positives in this performance here. Willian, what a brilliant start.
Yeah, I must say I've always been a little bit underwhelmed by Willian, and I think that's maybe why his signing wasn't greeted with particularly positive vibes from the Arsenal supporters. But I thought he finished last season in particular very well for Chelsea. And strangely, Arsenal don't really have a player in that kind of mould, a creative attacking midfielder, aside from Ozil, of course, who is still not involved. So yeah, it was a very good start for him. Obviously, he was involved in all three goals. He also hit the woodwork from a set piece, and the other signing got a goal as well. So yeah, I mean, I think this was a very gentle start for Arsenal. I mean, Fulham, it was almost identical side to the one which won the Championship playoff final. So they do have more cohesion than they did 2 years ago. I'm not particularly convinced they're going to be a better side based upon that performance. I think they were really lacking with and without the ball, really. Their pressing was... there was an intention to press, but I don't think it was quick enough or cohesive enough. And with the ball, I thought they looked a little bit lacking in ideas, to be honest. So, yeah, I wouldn't go OTT on Arsenal, but obviously 3-0 is a pretty good start.
That Mesut Ozil comparison, it took Willian just 57 minutes to register more assists for the Gunners than Ozil has managed in 18 Premier League appearances last season. Willian, as Daniel Story was pointing out on social media, is now Arsenal's second highest league assist provider in 2020. Remarkable.
Yeah, and not just that. Aside from him, the top chance creator from last season that started for Arsenal was Aubameyang with 26. And we know him ostensibly as a goal scorer, and 26 is clearly not very many at all. It would have put him about in the 90s in the Premier League last season. So, they needed that chance creator. I agree with Michael, though. I mean, this is a Fulham defence of which three of them started 18 games together in the Premier League 2 years ago, and they had the worst defence in the Premier League 2 years ago. You know, I know Scott Parker is absolutely determined to avoid this doing a Fulham by buying too many players, but there are middle grounds. And at the moment, their only new arrivals this summer, I think, are... I think Anthony Robinson they signed from Wigan, and they signed Areola, but no one that was in the squad on Saturday was new. So
Matt's super excited about Areola.
I think he'll make a bit of a tit of himself.
Very good. Yeah. Yeah, I think when Areola comes into the team, he'll offer them a bit more protection maybe than Rodak did on Saturday. And they've also signed Ola Aina on loan from Torino, somebody who I saw a lot of playing for Chelsea and who Antonio Conte in particular was a massive fan of, and had Conte stayed, I think that that Aina would have found himself playing regularly for Chelsea. So I think that's a good pickup. But defensively, the big worry for me with Fulham was Michael Hector, who, you know, I mentioned Ben White earlier as maybe the best defender in the Championship last season. Michael Hector wasn't far behind, and he looked woefully out of form in this game, and he's one of their key players, and the other one's Alexander Mitrovic, and he started on the bench due to an apparent lack of fitness. So slightly strange one from Parker, but they need to get performances out of those two if they're to have any hope. I mean, it's always difficult for the team that wins the playoffs because they have less time to prepare, and obviously that is magnified by a large amount this season because of the tight turnaround between the end of one season and the start of another, and it's not like Fulham were flying all the way through last season and expecting to go up. So it does look a very, very tricky task for a relatively rookie manager.
The 3-0 defeat was their 11th top flight derby defeat in a row. Where are they going to be next weekend in the Premier League? Elland Road against Leeds. Oof.
Quickly on Arsenal. I mean, we're right to say that we should hold back praise just yet, but it also should be said that the really impressive thing about what they've done is in both of their two games this season, both the Community Shield and the first game, they've scored exactly the type of goal that Mikel Arteta would want them to score, playing exactly the type of football he'd want them to play. And that's pretty good effort given how long he's been at the club. You know, it takes a fair amount of courage from him to implement that, but it also takes Martin Keogh mentioned on Saturday on commentary about kind of the communication between him and the senior pros that then drops down to the young players. And
was this the language comment?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't the language thing. Bless him. It was a good Martin Keown point about the communication between the players, which, yeah, it must have happened, and it must have happened quickly, because the one thing about Arsenal under Emery is that when they were playing well, even, it felt like the football was sort of happening to them, or the results were happening to them rather than them making it happen. Where for better and for worse now under Arteta, you can at least see a vision, and Arsenal fans will tell you there was no way that squad moves forward sustainably until they had that vision. There are still questions about whether they can replicate it, not against Fulham, of course. But yeah, I thought that the style of that third goal was, for all the over-exaggeration from Keown, was pretty good to watch.
Right.
More aggression, the key, according to Mohamed Elneny. We are much more aggressive now. Everyone, even the kit man, is focused on giving 100% every day. So maybe it's the aggressive kit man. Here's your kit, put it on. That's getting them fired up before.
Wow. Well, marginal gains.
I mean, that Arsenal away shirt does look like there has been some aggression leading up to the making of it. So,
do you know, I've seen so many kits and so many surprising kits that I can't actually picture it. What did it look like?
It's kind of like white and looks like it's slightly almost bloodstained.
Right. Yeah. But this one was blue, slightly controversially.
Why? Because it's Arsenal?
It's quite unusual for them to be.
Yeah, there's a few strange ones. Leicester wearing maroon felt particularly weird to me.
Yeah. Alrighty, also on Saturday, Newcastle had a big win at West Ham, featuring great debuts from their signings, Callum Wilson, Jeff Hendrick and Jamal Lewis, who popped up with an assist. And Palace made mockery of certain people's pre-season predictions with a 1-0 win over the much-fancied Saints. Ed Quoth the Raven says, can Pod show some appreciation for Andros Townsend, who put in the cross for Wilfred Zaha's goal? He's come in for criticism for a while and his place is under threat, but he responded with a really good game on Saturday, says Ed. Should I start again? Asks, do the panel think Zaha will play as well as possible while the transfer window is still open? And if it closes with no move, he will just tail off. Your thoughts?
Yes, to that last one, basically. Right. But I don't think anybody's going to buy him, despite... I like the Elneny quote, but quote of the week, Roy Hodgson on Zaha. He thinks it'd be nice if some club came in and paid the market price for him.
Wow. That's great.
How far do you think Newcastle can go? And I know we've only had 90 minutes, but they did look good.
Yeah, they look good against a West Ham side that after 90 minutes of the new season has already managed to become a crisis club, which is probably a new record, even by David's goals and Sullivan's standard reputation. It just looks so broken. You know, they've got a group of attacking midfielders that they signed for big money on big contracts who don't particularly want to be there anymore. But when they come on to chase a game and are forced to get neck ache from watching the ball being smashed from the back to the head of Sebastian Haller for Mikel Antonio to try and feed up off the scraps on, you kind of have some sympathy. You just don't see any plan at all. I said last week that I was surprised that the Grady Diangana signing was the straw that broke the camel's back, but boy, did they need a quick start to the season to kind of reverse that mood, and they got the opposite. They were absolutely terrible.
Well, next up then, let's have a look at Everton's win away at Spurs and whether they might be the Premier League's most improved side.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power.
Football 2, what a goal! What a header that is, Dominic Calvert-Lewin! Brilliantly headed home!
Sunny then, another episode of All or Nothing, Everton taking it all, and Spurs really contributing pretty much nothing in a 1-0 defeat at home to the Toffees. That was, as we mentioned back at the start, Everton's first away victory against the Big Six side since December 2013, 40 trips since then without a win, but they look very, very comfortable here. Paul Glover saying, Spurs midfield versus Everton midfield, discuss.
Yeah, I thought Everton were the better side throughout the game. I mean, even 10 minutes in, when Everton probably hadn't put together many attacking moves, I was just quite excited by watching them. I thought James Rodriguez showed some wonderful touches. He didn't necessarily have the end product, but just his first touch, his appreciation of space, the runs he was making. I thought looked really good. Allen in defensive midfield, probably the best player on the pitch. Doucouré, maybe not quite at his best, but we know what he can do. It's just the most exciting Everton side that I've seen for a while. And yeah, I thought they really deserved the win against the Spurs side, who were... It was one of those performances where I don't think you could probably get a single positive from it. It was not disastrous, but it was so flat. And yeah, maybe with the exception of Doherty, who made some good runs and got into goal scoring position as he does very well, or has done very well for Wolves. But aside from that, I thought they were disjointed and lack of pressing. I thought Son and Kane seemed to be on a couple of occasions not understanding each other and not being on the same wavelength. Yeah, early days, but that was worrying for Spurs.
Well, there was one moment, a couple of breaks that Spurs had before Everton took the lead when it looked like Son could set up the oncoming Harry Kane, but instead decided to hang on to the ball and feed Dele Alli instead, possibly because he knows that Harry Kane never scores in the opening month of the season, whether it's August or September. But was the most worrying aspect for Tottenham the fact that the game effectively ended when Everton scored rather than that sparking a reaction? I think the next 5 minutes had 76% possession for the visitors.
Yeah, and the person who tweeted in about midfield, I think probably what they were alluding to was that there was nothing coming from Harry Winks in terms of creativity, and presumably what they bought Højbjerg for was to provide some steel and some effective simple passing, and you know, there he was getting the ball from a throw-in and kicking it straight out of play. It was an extremely inauspicious debut from him. We used to seeing Harry Kane look sluggish at the start of the season, but as you say, the whole team just really, really woeful. And it's difficult, therefore, to say whether Everton were brilliant and, you know, these three new midfielders, attacking players, all settled in brilliantly really quickly, or whether they were just given the freedom of the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium and actually that was the reason that they were able to look so good.
Right. Carlo Ancelotti talking afterwards about James Rodriguez and his ability to handle the pace of the Premier League. And that's one thing that, in terms of the speed of the game, wasn't really a factor in this. So as such, we haven't perhaps seen how well he'll be adapted to one of those kind of breakneck Premier League classics. But very, very fine start for him and Everton this year. Spurs are going to be off in Bulgaria, actually, on Thursday, second qualifying round of the Europa League. It's a round of matches that will throw up all sorts of interesting clashes, including Shamrock Rovers against Milan. But anyway, Lokomotiv Plovdiv is who's going to be hosting Spurs. Catch that one Thursday. Also on Sunday, a little bit earlier on, Leicester were 3-0 winners at West Brom. Did this take you a bit by surprise?
I mean, Leicester started pretty slowly and they had an incredibly makeshift defence in which Wilfred Ndidi was forced to play central defence. James Justin was also played slightly out of position. But as soon as Leicester scored the first goal, West Brom just capitulated. And as we've said about Fulham, it feels very killjoy to damn promoted clubs to a season of doom based on the opening weekend. But boy, do they need some better players in, because Kyle Bartley is not a Premier League central defender, I'm afraid. And you know, for all the excellence of Grady Diangana and Mateus Pereira last season in the Championship, they're not going to get as much time on the ball in the Premier League. And you know, West Brom's top goal scorers last season in the league got 10 each, and that was Hal Robson-Kanu and Charlie Austin. I'd be, you know, if either of them reaches 10 this season, that will be a success story, and they're still their starting strikers. So yeah, there's a huge amount of work to do. I do wonder with you know, the bigger picture stuff with COVID and the kind of uncertain financial climate, I do wonder if Fulham and West Brom are thinking but not saying, let's just bank our money and see what happens, because at least they know they will have a financial future that hasn't involved them spending £20-30 million on players who, on big contracts, if they go down. But the gap between those and, you know, as I say, an under par in terms of personnel Leicester team was pretty worrying, I think.
Among the positives for Leicester, meanwhile, the return of James Maddison from the bench in this game, and Jamie Vardy getting a brace, a couple of penalties for him, after which he made sure to cup his ears to the home end, which of course was empty, but you know, the point still stands. What is the beef there, Daniel?
The beef is basically that West Brom fans constantly taunted Jamie Vardy, which many home and away fans do, but he particularly, let's say, basks in the hate from the West Brom fans. He was recently asked for his all-time top favourite kits, Jamie Vardy, and he didn't pick the Leicester City home kit from the Premier League winning season, but he did pick a West Brom kit just because, as a kind of, I love this kit so much because whenever I see it, I know I'm going to score that day, which is, I think we're probably fair to say, pure Jamie Vardy.
Very nice. Anything else on this game, or indeed on any of the weekend's matches, before we get on to what awaits on the Monday?
Not necessarily specifically about this match, although it did apply to this match. I was a little bit surprised that quite a few managers didn't use all three substitutions, just because it's going to be a long season. They haven't had a long pre-season. They're used to using five subs. And just this was one of the games where, yeah, Rodgers only used two substitutes. You would have thought maybe give Iheanacho or Choudhury or Fuchs or someone else on the bench a run out. But yeah, I thought managers would be using up their subs whenever possible, but it seems that's not the case.
Just on what Daniel said about Fulham and West Brom, I agree with that, actually, but I'd like to know what Slaven Bilic thinks about it, because I would imagine that as an inexperienced manager, Scott Parker more sort of malleable to what his owners want, but Slaven Bilic maybe would have expected a bit more backing, albeit in circumstances that he couldn't have predicted. He'd said that being in the Championship was a bucket list thing for him to do, but I think he probably meant just for one season.
I see.
A quick any other business on Andy Carroll, who managed to elbow Thomas Souček fully in the cheek after, I think, 18 seconds of the game on Saturday night. The ball from kickoff just went to the back, immediately high ball played up. Carroll went in, leading with his elbow. The VAR checked it, and I was watching with the sound down, and I assumed he was going to be sent off. I think if it had been happened midway through the second half, he might well have been, but he just kind of got calmed down from the referee before doing pretty much exactly the same about 6 minutes later. So it's good to have Andy Carroll back.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Listener, as mentioned, it's September the 14th still, unless you're really taking your time with this show. On this day in history, do you know what happened? It was the first ever double-figure scoreline in the Football League. All the way back in 1889, on September the 14th, Preston defeated Stoke 10-0. Woof. I bet they thought back in those days that would be par for the course, but it's not. It has happened 62 times in the intervening century and a bit, but never, of course, in the Premier League. The biggest Football League scoreline, do you know what that is? Anybody?
13-1.
It is. It's 13-0. It's happened three times. I think most recently in the 50s, but the most recent double figures we've had in the Football League was 87, when Manchester City defeated Huddersfield Town 10-1. That was in a second division match. Paul Stewart, Tony Adcock and David White each grabbing hat-tricks against a Terriers side that had just appointed Malcolm McDonald. He would be fired and they finished bottom and all that sort of thing. As I say, we're still waiting for the first club to score 10 goals in a Premier League match. Will we ever see that, do you think?
Yes, we will.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, unless a European Super League plan is accelerated reasonably quickly, then yes, we will. Everything is moving further apart in terms of finances and gap at the top rather than being narrowed. So yes, we will eventually.
I'm not sure. I feel like it's a barrier beyond which...
From the logic that we've had nine plenty of times, including one last season, not even right. by a big six club, I think we will.
But even there, it was perfectly set up to reach double figures, and yet something just seemed to...
Well, of course, Johnny Evans was very keen to get the 10th in that game, wasn't he? He knew the record and was desperately gesturing for his teammates to get the ball quickly so they could inflict further misery on Southampton. I mean, we saw it last year in the WSL, didn't we? Arsenal was at Bristol City away. And this weekend, we've had two nines. We have our Arsenal beating West Ham 9-1 and Chelsea scoring nine as well with nine different goal scorers. So maybe you're right, James. Maybe it's just a barrier that there's
man's not meant to, you know, or woman indeed in this
case.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, well, having a go at maybe reaching double figures on Monday will be Sheffield United and Wolves, who will meet at Bramall Lane, and Brighton and Chelsea. Perhaps that one's a little bit more, conditions are more favourable. I don't know.
Egg on your face, James, when they all score 10.
Yeah. Brighton, Chelsea, you'll be commentating on that one, Matt, for Chelsea TV. How are Chelsea going to line up, do you think?
Well, they've got some players who won't be playing. So Thiago Silva, kind of only just out of quarantine, only joined up with training last week, so he's not going to feature. Ben Chilwell still got the injury that he arrived with. Hakim Ziyech picked up an injury in pre-season. Mateo Kovacic is suspended, but I would expect that you would see Kai Havertz and Timo Werner. It was only a couple of weeks ago I commentated on this fixture, the only pre-season game that Chelsea have played. You remember it was one where 2,500 fans were let in to the game, which is obviously 2,500 more than will be there for this one. But yeah, I would suspect that we will see Havertz and probably Werner. And Werner scored after 4 minutes in the game between these two a couple of weeks ago. So it's going to be interesting to see how Frank Lampard, Crowbars, all these new signings in at the top end, but we are going to get pretty much the same defence, certainly for this game that was so porous last season. We're thinking that Edouard Mendy seems to be close to joining Chelsea as competition/replacement for Kepa, but obviously not in time for this game.
Matt, the central defencing for Chelsea, is that set in stone? I understand that when Thiago Silva's fit, they might start Zouma over Rudiger. Is that a thing, or is Rudiger still the centre back?
That wouldn't surprise me, to be perfectly honest, because I think that Lampard thinks that Zouma is a better bet in the air than Rudiger, which I would agree with. And I think that Rudiger often is kind of defaulted to as Chelsea's best defender because he is pretty much the most experienced rather than based actually on the performances that he put in a lot of time last season. I mean, Lampard, like previous Chelsea managers, has been desperate to try and make Andreas Christensen a regular in his team because he's so good on the ball, but defensively he's just not been up to scratch for the last season or so. So I would suspect it would be Zouma and Rudiger tomorrow. But yeah, none of them are certain of their place. And you know, there's still half a chance they might get Declan Rice in. There's still a chance they might do what they did in the friendly against Brighton and put Azpilicueta in there as well and go to three at the back. So that's the area definitely that still needs much work doing.
Are you expecting it to be as tight as that friendly, which finished 1-1 on Monday evening?
I'm not, to be honest, and this will make me look very daft to people listening on Tuesday morning, I'm sure, but I actually think Chelsea might win this quite comfortably. I quite like Brighton. I think they'll have a decent season, but I'm not sure where their goals come from because Mopé really sort of fell off a cliff after the restart, and that would be my big concern for them. Albeit, I think they've got an excellent looking defence now with Webster and Dunk and the returning Ben White. So it might be tricky, but if Chelsea score early, I think they might be able to run in a couple of goals and win fairly comfortably.
Okay. Before that match on Monday, 6 o'clock, Sheffield United will be hosting Wolves. There's not been much mention of the Blades in previews as people's kind of top half contenders. Why do you think that is?
I would say because people are very focused on signings and they haven't made any major signings.
Right, much as they didn't last year.
Kind of. I mean, they did subtly. I think they broke their record transfer fee 4 times last summer without anyone noticing. But yeah, I mean, they've replaced the goalkeeper, haven't they? Obviously, they would have liked to have kept Henderson. They've got back Ramsdale. I don't think he's quite as good as Henderson. So that's a slight downgrade. I think they'll do okay again. I think they might struggle to get ninth place again, not necessarily because they'll be worse, but because I think a few other sides are probably going to be better, like Southampton, Everton, as we've mentioned. So I think it'll be more competitive for a top half finish. But I don't really see any danger that they'll have a second season syndrome as others have in the past. I just think they are quite a good team.
Yeah, there are two ways of looking at it. One is nobody's talking about Sheffield United for the top 6 or 7 or 8. The other thing is that they're not talking about Sheffield United for relegation, which, given where they were 2-3 years ago, is a remarkable feat. You know, Sheffield United and Wolves are the two clubs who have very quickly, in very, very different ways, kind of established themselves as automatic stay-up picks in the Premier League for teams that were in the Championship not that long ago. So that, I kind of see it as a compliment. Chris Wilder will think if nobody's talking about Sheffield United, that's probably a good thing because it means everything's pretty much bobbing along fine.
Yeah, and whilst their signings aren't particularly eye-catching, they are all interesting. Jaden Bogle and Max Lowe from Derby, but both have very good seasons last season. Oliver Burke, a player who's really lost his way, having been so highly touted when he left Forest for Leipzig. Interesting to see if Chris Wilder can get something out of him. You know, he couldn't or chose not to with Ravel Morrison. And then Ethan Ampadu, who's another player who, you know, I've obviously kept a close eye on, but had a loan spell that didn't work out at Leipzig last season. So it's a big one for him with the Euros coming up at the end of the season, and he's often looked a pretty pivotal player when he's played for Wales. So not quite make or break, but for somebody who was playing senior football at the age of 15, he's definitely seen his career stall largely through no fault of his own over the last couple of years. So it feels important that he nails down a place in the team, whether that be as a central defender or a holding midfielder.
The spectre of second season syndrome, meanwhile. Previous examples of the genre included Ipswich, who finished fifth in 2001 and then got relegated the following season. Reading also going down in 2008 after finishing eighth in 2007.
But neither of those teams, from my very distant memory, neither of those teams had anywhere near such a set strategy for approaching their opponents in the Premier League as Sheffield United do. And Wilder sees no reason to change that. They did drop off after lockdown, it should be said. But yeah, I think they will pick up enough points in games where people expect them to maybe draw or maybe lose that they'll be fine.
Okay. They may be more than fine. We shall see. Wolves anyway, the opposition, where manager Nuno Espirito Santo has just signed a new 3-year contract. Zafod 5 saying that could be Wolves' biggest signing of the summer. Indeed it could. Although I'm very interested to see this highly touted Fabio Silva kid.
Yes. Know. The man of all the agents' fees.
Right. Yes. That's all coming up on Monday. Still to come in today's show, we'll be touching on some of the big stories around the world of football beyond the Premier League. First, though, odds with Lee Price.
Hello, listeners. Or should I say listener? Hi, Mum. What a breathless weekend of football that was. The games keep on coming, and tonight we have an early example of why I don't do the numbers at Paddy Power. Yes, all right, I'm not that bright. But also, I just can't separate Sheffield United and Wolves. They're two teams I find it very difficult to write off. Thankfully, the actual adults on Power Tower are more decisive, and they make Wolves the favourites here at 13-10, with Sheffield United priced at 12-5. The other game, to be fair, I find easier to call, and our traders make Chelsea, now known as the Stamford Globetrotters, odds on to beat Brighton, who are a chunky 4-1 to get a win. Elsewhere, Mo Salah's hat-trick makes him the clear favourite in the Golden Boot market, obviously, but to be fair, he was joint favourite anyway, and it is a long season. The other notable reactions to the weekend came with Arsenal, yes, Arsenal, shortening in the top four race, although we still think they'll finish fifth, and David Moyes cementing his spot at the top of the sack race betting market. Harsh. Leeds did quite well, I don't know if you noticed. Twitter would have told you that relentlessly if you follow any of their supporters, and Leeds are now even to finish in the top 10, leapfrogging Southampton in that market. And yes, I'll say it, they were very good.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Matt, you were getting very excited this week on social about Man City's academy lineup.
Yeah, it doesn't take much to make me laugh. And when you see City with Slicker in goal, I, you know, enjoyed Billy Crystal's work as much as anybody. That right. Certainly did make me smile.
So City, what is this? They're under 18s or something?
It was the development squad, so under 23s.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, and this is Kieran Slicker, born in Oldham, Scotland, under 18 international. According to Manchester City's website, he is an agile shot stopper and a calming presence between the sticks. That very much looks like a copy and paste job from whoever's written that.
Nice. I noticed there's also a Wright Phillips in the lineup that you tweeted.
Yes, and this is Sean's son, DiMaggio. Yeah, he's been there for a while. Wanna feel old? Sean Wright, Phillips' son, etc. and so on.
Crikey. Alrighty. Now, loads coming up across the Totally Network. Monday, Matt, you're going to be hosting the Totally Football League show, the first of the week's two editions. What are you going to be talking about? A bit of Harrogate, perhaps?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Harrogate 4-0 winners at Southend in their first game in the EFL. They've got this great situation whereby Simon Weaver, the manager, Harrogate just into the EFL. He is now the EFL's longest serving manager. So we'll definitely be talking about them. Barrow, the other new boys, conceded a harsh penalty late on. Drew 1-1 with Stevenage, but they were cheered by a message of support flown over by Morecambe saying good luck in the EFL, which was quite nice to see. Yeah, very good. So we've got Robin Cowan of Match of the Day and Final Score and WSL coverage on the BBC with Adrian Clark and Sam Parkin. And so that's the Monday show. And then Thursday, it's the Totally Football League show, Extra Time with Ali Maxwell and George Ellick.
Crikey. Meantime, there's more WSL coverage in the Offside Rules WSL edition, which is coming up on Tuesday. And we'll certainly be taking in those 9-goal wins for Chelsea and Arsenal, and of course Alex Morgan's arrival at Spurs should be good for cup action, etc. and so on. She was the tea drinking USA forward who sparked controversy with her goal celebrations.
Well, she was also probably the best player of the tournament as well.
Also, I mean, that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, let's be fair, this is a massive signing. You look at the results from the WSL this weekend, as I mentioned, two of the big sides scored 9 goals. You know, there's a real danger of the top three in the WSL just almost eating up everyone else, and it being a division of two divisions. And this is exciting, not just because it's a big name like Pernille Harder or, you know, the others that have gone to the big sides, but she's gone to a side who have only been in the WSL for one season. So, you know, hopefully she's the kind of player who is good enough to really take them to new heights. So, yeah, I think it's by far the most exciting signing the WSL has seen. I know we've said that a few times this summer, but yeah, more than ever with her.
If Spurs women can sign a top striker, why can't the men's side?
On a very tenuous link to that, it is interesting that I saw someone asking whether Daniel Levy, because it was a deal of such magnitude, whether Daniel Levy would have got involved in a deal like that. And I don't know the answer, but it would be interesting to know it because, you know, the commercial potential of having Morgan, even on a fairly short-term deal for Spurs women, will be absolutely ginormous. And it would be really pleasing to me if he did get involved in that, if he saw it as an opportunity for Spurs as a, you know, as a complete brand rather than just for the women's team. So I don't know, and it's remarkably hard to get, you know, straight answers out of Daniel Levy or even get to him at all, but it would be interesting to know.
Okay. Also out on Tuesday, in what's looking a very busy day for your ears, listener, is the Totally Scottish Football Show, which may or may not touch on the dramatic situation at St Mirren, where they had not one, not two, but three goalkeepers going down with coronavirus. So, And on the same day, Totally Football Show European Edition will be out with Rafa, Jules, Alvaro and James Horncastle. And a bit of homework, actually, if you want to check out the remarkable goal scored by Irvin Cardona for Brest. You've seen that, haven't you, Michael?
No, I've not seen any Brest on the internet this week, no.
Yeah, so it's just extraordinary.
Ce que je disais tout à l'heure, et c'est même le défenseur central écolier mondial. Oh là là, but
exceptionnel! Put in extraordinary Brest action into Google. It will come up, no question about that. You might also check out the remarkable miss from that Belgian game, the details of which I don't have in front of me, but it's just none more.
No, it's not about the details with that miss, is it? Really?
He's basically stood with the ball at his feet in front of goal, and he stands on it and falls over.
He had about 3 seconds and 3 touches, and yes, somehow managed to skew it along the goal line out for a goal kick.
I'm just watching this Irvin Cardona goal, and it's better than that Di Canio volley for West Ham all those years ago. Is that fair?
Right. Because there's a similar kind of physics-defying bit of action. He leaps into the air and does I'm not entirely sure what, a kind of scissor kick?
Yeah, and he's on an angle as well. So to score past the keeper at his near post from there is pretty special. But he gets his both feet up so high off the ground. I'm calling it. That's better than Di Canio.
Crikey. Other big European stories that we'll be featuring probably on Tuesday include Paris Saint-Germain's nightmare start to the season. They lost against Lens in their opening game, and then the big classique with Marseille Sunday night. We'll be touching on probably Eden Hazard and the Eden Hazard, because he's turned up overweight again. And looking ahead to the start of the Bundesliga and Serie A campaigns, and of course previewing Milan's visit to Shamrock Rovers in the second qualifying round of the Europa League that we mentioned a little bit earlier on. As Daniel Story wrote, absolutely gutting that a generation of kids will miss out watching a game live that would be a footballing anecdote they could treasure for years.
Yeah, they played Juventus in 2010, and there's photos of Del Piero wearing a Shamrock Rovers shirt at the end of the game. But yes, it's obviously gutting that the game will be played and no one will go.
Indeed. Well, that's it for today's show. Hope you've enjoyed our thoughts on the opening 90 minutes of this campaign. Many thanks to Daniel, Michael and Matt. And do enjoy all the shows throughout the week and have a great week in general, listener. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of the Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
Muddy Knees Media.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.